Okay, good morning. This is the first part of our two sections of the of our Pesach Haggadah seminar, and I would like to share with you some insights into the Haggadah. Some of these are my own. Some of these I've gotten from other places, and in all cases, some of these are a little shorter. Some of these are a little longer. Perhaps you'll be able to use at your Seder, and perhaps we will also be able to share with each other and bring out additional insights. So I want to start with the beginning of the Haggadah, or towards the beginning of the Haggadah, and we'll begin with Kadesh. So Kadesh is interesting. Morty was just saying that Kadesh has is Kiddush. So why do we call it Kadesh and rather than calling it Kiddush? So anybody have any thoughts on that? Right. So why do we call it Kiddush? So many of the commentaries point out that when it comes to Kadesh, Kadesh is not just about reciting Kiddush, but it is an affirmative statement of sanctification. We are sanctifying. We are taking an active, affirmative initiative in order to be Mekadesh the Chol. And specifically when it comes to Pesach, one of the things that really comes to mind is the notion of Zman, the notion of time. I'm going to talk a little bit more about this at the Shabbos Haggadah Drasha, but when it comes to Pesach, the Jewish people were freed from slavery, and as a result of being freed from slavery, the one thing which is significant and defining to a slave, to an Eved, is he has no control over his time. The master tells him to do this, to do that, to do the other thing. He has no control over his time whatsoever. Right? People even use the expression, they're a slave to their job. What does it mean they're a slave to their job? That means that they don't have any control over their time. They can't decide what they want to do, when they want to do, because they're entirely enslaved to the responsibilities of that position. So the quality, the defining quality of a slave is that he has no control over his time. And the defining quality of a free person, and an Eved Hashem, a servant of Hashem, is, and Chayrus, is to have control over one's time, and therefore responsibility over one's time. Kadesh is an active, affirmative statement of what we are about to do, what we are engaging in, and that is, as free people, we take control over our time. And Rav Soloveitchik and others famously explain that we end off Kiddush, Baruch Atah Hashem, Mekadesh Yisrael v'Hazmanim, it's as opposed to Shabbos, which is Mekadesh HaShabbos, because when it comes to Shabbos, it's the seventh day, regardless of who says what, it's still going to be Shabbos. But when it comes to Yontif, what makes Yontif Yontif is the fact that Beis Din declared Rosh Chodesh 15 days ago. It is by the determination of the Jewish people, in essence, that the day has been declared holy. It is a function of our hands. Yeah, I mean, God gives us the mitzvah, and God puts it into our lap. But at the end of the day, it is a function of Yisrael v'hazmanim, as the Rav pointed out. So Kadesh is an affirmative statement of our initiative to do something here to be Mekadesh the Chol, and to be Mekadesh the Zman. So just a little tidbit on the difference between Kadesh and Kiddush. Now, when it comes to Manishtana, so Manishtana, of course, are four questions. But are they really four questions? Are they really four questions? It looks like it's one question and four answers, if you read it a certain way. Manishtana halayla hazemikol lelos. How is this night, or why is this night different from all other nights? The answer is, right, if you say how, then it's Shabbachol Halilos, on all other nights we do this, and all the nights we do that, and all the nights we do this, and all the other nights we do that. So, so from what, you could read this really as one question with four answers to it. That's if you read it as, how is this night different than all other nights? Of course, if you read it as, why is this night different than all other nights, which is the sort of the simple pshat the way we ordinarily read it. So, ma nishtana, why is this night different from all other nights? It's more like lama nishtana, why is this night different than all other nights? Then these are four supports to that question. Why is this night different than all other nights? In that, we do this. Why is this night different than all other nights? In that, we do X. In that, we do Y. And I think that's probably how we most ordinarily explain it. I saw in the name of Rav Soloveitchik that he says, Ma nishtan halayla zeh is a sort of a statement of, maybe like a statement of wonder. Ma nishtana, how unique is this night? This night is an extraordinarily unique night. And then we go on to say, you know, why and how this night is unique. But the way I like to read Manishtana, you could read it, how is this night different than all other nights? Right? Why is this night different than all other nights? But I like to focus on the second word and read it perhaps a little homiletically. I'm not sure if it's exact pshat, but Manishtana means, I want to say, Ma means the word what, not how or why, but rather the way we ordinarily use the word Ma, which is what, you know, what. So Ma Nishtana, what is different on this night? Or, I would say it more precisely, what is changed on this night? Right? On all other nights we do this, on all tonight we do that. On all other nights we do this, on all we do that. But it seems to me that Ma Nishtana on a deeper level is what is changed on this night? And the answer must be you and me, the participants of the Seder. We must be transformed by the Seder experience, right? Has to be one in which we experience a closeness to Hashem, gives us frames the way we should experience the Seder. Should be one in which we are edified by learning from others at the Seder, or through or through sharing, right? So that's we are transformed through that experience, or through a greater appreciation of the blessings that Hashem has given us in our lives, as you know, historically for the Jewish people, for Yitzias Mitzrayim, or in our own personal lives. So there are three different ways to read Manishtana. Manishtana, how is this night different from all other nights? Or as the Rav said, it's a rhetorical question, how unique is this night? Or Manishtana, why is this night different than all other nights? And in that we do these several things. Or the way I'm suggesting, Manishtana is not how or why, but what. What is Nishtana? What is changed? What is transformed? What is different? And the answer has to be, we are different as a result of the Seder. And I think this is a perfect way for everybody to begin their Seder, because it sets a framework and sets a tone for what we're about to do. And who traditionally says the Manishtana? The kids at the Seder, right? The little kids. If there are no little kids at the Seder, then an adult says it. But the little kids say it at the Seder. And I think that it's a beautiful tie-in, because children are all about transformation and change. That's what they're doing for the first X amount of years of their life. Very pronounced. And then, you know, we get to a certain point and we sort of become, you know, fixed in our ways, fixed in our bodies, fixed in our looks, fixed in our shape, fixed in our thinking, fixed. So Manishtana, talking about change and transformation, being recited by an agent of change and transformation, which is a young child, again helps us to frame how we should be experiencing the Seder. It's a time of change and a time of transformation. So Manishtana acts as a wonderful introduction to the Seder from this perspective of setting the tone, and it also introduces this notion of the focus. The focus on the young person. I want to sort of, I guess, you know, skip around a little bit. We're not going to exactly go in order, sort of thematically, based on what I was just saying, I want to skip a little forward in the Haggadah to after Avadim Hayinu. We start with Maisa Rabbi Eliezer of Rabbi Yoshua. By the way, the Mishnah Berurah I pointed out the other day says that some people don't realize what they're doing, and they keep the kids up for Manishtana, and then it's late, and they send the kids to sleep right after Manishtana. So he says this is like it's bringing the horse to water, but not letting him drink. You're only doing half the thing. The whole purpose of Manishtana is to get to the answer, and the answer is, why is this night different? Why is this night unique? And the answer is because we are commemorating Avadim Hayinu, that we were slaves in Egypt and when we came out of Mitzrayim. So if we send the kids to sleep after Manishtana, we've lost the purpose of the manishtana. Number one, and number two, we've lost the opportunity to fulfill the mitzvah of vihigata telavincha, of declaring and teaching teaching the next generation. So that's just as an aside point. Okay, so I think we're all using different haggadahs, but right after Avadim Hayinu, we start with this story of Maaser Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Yoshua. So there are a few things to notice in this story over here. So let's read it. Maaser Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Yoshua Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah Rabbi Akiva Rabbi Tarfon Shehayu Mesubin Bivnei Brak. So all these rabbis got together, and they were having their seder in Bnei Brak. Why were they having their seder in Bnei Brak? Because it's the most religious place in Israel, I guess, right? Why were they having their seder in Bnei Brak? So that's an important question to ask. We'll get back to that in a moment. And they were involved in the storytelling of Egypt all night long. Ad shebo talmideim v'amru lahem, until their students came to them and said, Raboseinu, higiyaz man kriya shema shel shacharis, the time for kriya shema has come. Probably one of the most famous pieces in the Haggadah. I would like to turn your attention on your sheet to a very similar Seder that also happened at this point in time. And take a look on sheet number one, okay, the section that is labeled Two Seder Nights. Tell me if it sounds familiar or not. Okay, so it reads as follows. Okay, this also comes from the Tosefta. Once, Rabbi Gamliel and the sages were reclining in the house of Vaitus, son of Zonin, in Lud, and they were involved in the laws of Pesach all night until the roosters crowing. They opened the window, collected themselves, and they went out to the study hall. Maaser Rabbi Gamliel is a kenev shayu mesubin beveis baisus ben zonin belud v'hayu asukin bilchas Pesach kol alayla ad kros hagever higbiu milifneiam. They picked themselves up. This piece is cut off, and they went to the base medrash. So this is a very similar story to the one that is in the Haggadah. The one that is in the Haggadah has Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi at the house of Rabbi Akiva. That's one Seder that's going on. And then the Tosefta has another Seder that's going on, and that is Rabbi Gamliel and the Zakenim in the house of Baitus. So what are the differences in these two stories? What are the differences in these two stories? Number one, the people are different, right? Different place. One is in the house of Rabbi Akiva Bnei Brak. The other one is in Lud by the airport, right? In the house of Baitus, right? What else what else are distinctions in these two stories?
These two things are happening in the same time frame or different people?
They're in the same time frame. I don't know if it's the exact same Seder night, but you know, our teaching would work better if it is the exact same Seder night. But nevertheless, the same, basically same time period. Yeah, in the Haggadah, the Talmidim come and say Higia, and it's time for what? What is it time for?
Shacharis.
Right. It's time for Kriya Shema. And in the other version, in the Seder of Rabbi Gamliel and Beis Baisus,
it says the rooster's crowing.
Right, the rooster's crowing, and they're going to go to the Beis Medrash, which means, I guess, to daven. Right, I think that's fair to say. So, what are they discussing in these two Seders? Well, look carefully. Right. So in the Haggadah, they're talking about Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, the story of Mitzrayim, and in the other version, in the Seder of Rabbi Gamliel, so there they're studying Hilchos Pesach. So there are significant differences. I mean, the story overall looks the same, but there are significant differences. So, you know, it's like six half a dozen, really. Couldn't the Baal Haggadah, the author of the Haggadah, the codifier, the organizer of the Haggadah, couldn't he have put in this other story? I'm sure he knew this story also. I mean, there's also it's also in the statements of Chazal. So, what is it about the story of the Seder of Rabbi Akiva that perhaps supersedes the story of the Seder of Rabbi Gamliel and the Zakenah. So I want to read to you, you have it on your sheets here, Rabbi Yehuda Leib Maimon, who's one of the great scholars and rabbis in Israel. I think he died in the 1950s, I'm not exactly sure when, but there's a publishing house in his name. He was one of the great scholars in Israel. Anyway, so Rav Maimon in his Chagim U'Moadim writes the following. There is room to hypothesize, and you can read it in the Hebrew if you want on the second page. There is room to hypothesize, and I thank Rabbi Weintraub for this translation. There is room to hypothesize that the account of the Seder in Bnei Brak is also a historical anecdote from some work of Medrash or work of Agadah regarding the discussions and councils of the great sages of Israel when they gathered in the center of nationalist zeal, Bnei Brak, the residence of Rabbi Akiva, to speak of the exodus from Egypt. So he says that Bnei Brak was the center of nationalist zeal during the time of the rabbis. And Rabbi Akiva is well known that Rabbi Akiva was a supporter of Bar Kokhba and the Bar Kokhba rebellion. In fact, Rabbi Akiva and others may have even considered that he was going to lead them to Geula, to ultimate redemption. The Mashiach time would be here. So Rabbi Maimon continues that they came to have their Seder with Rabbi Akiva to discuss the Exodus, the time of our freedom, and also to express ideas and arrange counsel on the matter of the movement for freedom, which then enveloped the nation. So Rabbi Akiva's house was like, name one of our founding fathers in Boston, who had these secret soirees, planning the revolution. So I would suggest that maybe, it was a double goal over here. On the one hand, to have the Seder. On the other hand, they were going to discuss the revolution which they were going to launch. All of them responded to Rabbi Akiva's call, and each of them came from his place to celebrate the holiday of freedom in Bnei Brak, and to take counsel together in one secret Seder without the participation of their students. So I think Jake pointed out that in one case it was the students that were there, in the other case the students were not there. Regarding the appropriate and necessary role of the sages of Israel in the zealous movement which waved the flag of the rebellion against Rome. So they were going to sit, they were taking counsel amongst one another. What would be the role of the rabbis? What would be the role of the clergy in this rebellion? Do we take a leadership role, or do they take a back seat to it? Rav Soloveitchik famously pointed out that the Jewish people went from slavery to freedom, from being slaves in Egypt to standing before Har Sinai and accepting the Torah, going up those 49 levels of Tumah V'Tahara in 7 weeks. It's really, who can take a nation and transform a people in 7 weeks? Forget transform people, take yourself. People spend their whole lifetime trying to change themselves. So how is it that they were able to do it? Rav Soloveitchik points out that there are two ways to measure time. Two ways to measure time. There's time on the clock, right, as the time ticks by. And then there's quantitative time, and there's qualitative time. And that qualitative time is not measured by how much time goes by. For example, if you're a kid in school, so it's the last 5 minutes before the bell rings, and the kid is looking at that every single second going by, those last 5 minutes can be experienced as a year, right? For example, when I was used to teach high school, I pointed out that kids, rarely somebody goes to watch a movie. Most of the time, people don't get up, within 20 minutes to go use the restroom or to go out or take a walk or whatever. Sometimes people will sit a movie for the entire time. And maybe they'll go out once, whatever it is. But the bottom line is that when a person is in a certain experience and they feel time can go by very quickly, right? So time is not an objective experience. It is subjectively experienced. My parents were big camping people, and they used to, we worked at various camps over the years. And in our basement in the house where I was growing up, they had a sign in the basement, and it said, in terms of the summer, a day is like a week is like a month is like a half a year, and 2 months is like a year. Anybody who experienced, you know, going to camp for the summer, it's like a whole year of experience sort of encapsulated into that. It can be, for some people, it can be actually transformative, the development that they go through in 8 weeks of a positive summer experience. So time is not quantitative alone. There's also qualitative time. And Rabbi Akiva was wondering with his compatriots, and perhaps maybe even taking a stand on this issue, which he did, what, you know, how do we view this? Are we ready for revolution? It's only been 70 years since the Roman invasion, the Roman expulsion. So are we ready to, you know, to fight back? Maybe we need more time. And the answer is no. It's Pesach. Pesach tells us when the Jewish people get together, and the Jewish people are ready to be transformed, and the Jewish people are ready to move forward. Time is not an issue. We sanctify time. We are Mekadesh Vizman. We are the ones who make time happen, as it were. Time does not happen to us. So the Seder in Bnei Brak is the one that is incorporated into the Seder. The story of the Seder in Bnei Brak is the one that is indeed incorporated into the Seder because it fits so beautifully with the notion of Geula. We've been waiting now 2,000 years for a Geula. Right? But maybe we don't have to wait. Maybe it's time to make it happen, to be Mekadesh the Zman. Right? And with the good graces of the Ribbono Shel Olam, Geula can happen keharafayin, in a moment's notice. So the notion of the notion of Zman, which is where we started out here this morning, is incorporated in our opening Kaddish. We see it certainly in the Manish Tana, and we see it here in the story of the Seder. But there's another distinction here that I wanted to point out, and I saw this. I saw this written somewhere. I don't remember who attribute it appropriately, but it's not my own. the fact of the matter is that in these two stories, one is talking about Hilchos Pesach, and one is talking about Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. So Hilchos Pesach are important, but Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim is a much bigger thing. Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim is about identity. Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim is about Mesorah, is about transmitting an identity, about transmitting a tradition. Hilchos Pesach is definitely important. You have to know, you have to know what to do in any one particular time. So, do we have to do this? Do we have to do that? That's all very important. And it is part of the story. But Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim is the backdrop. It's the big story. That's the one which sets the tone and defines the theme of the Seder. In fact, if you read through the Seder, there's very little that talks about halachas. Right? Most of the, there are a couple of lines here and there. But most of the Seder is not talking about a pilpul in the shiurim. Do I have to have a third of a matzah or half of a matzah? Right? That's not what the Seder is about. The Seder is really about Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. Rav Soloveitchik, I saw quoted, said that the notion of Sipur comes from, which means a story, but also comes from, shares an etymology with the word sofer. What does sofer mean? A scribe. What is the role of a scribe? The role of a scribe is to take, quill to parchment, pen to paper, right? And to impress something, in our case, the Torah, onto this paper. We at the Seder, or the adults at the Seder, serve the function of being a sofer, of being a scribe. And our role at the Seder, to pick up the other theme which I started out with Manish Tana, the role of us at the Seder is to inscribe, to impress upon the younger generation that might be at the Seder, in order to be able to pass on the Mesorah, whether it is our own children, whether we're at a Seder where there are children, where there are children, there is an opportunity, and even if there are no children at a Seder, we get to impress on one another. We get to be sofrim. That's what it means, Sipur Sipur Yitzias Mitzrayim. Okay, so there are two different versions here of the story of Bnei Brak and the story in Lud. I want to make one final comment on these distinctions. Rabbi Akiva is well known for a great character trait. Anybody know what Rabbi Akiva's great character trait was? I mean, he had what? Nope, that was not. Rabbi Akiva was the great optimist. Rabbi Akiva was the great optimist. And you might remember the story that after the Churban HaBayis, Rabbi Akiva was, the Rabbi Akiva and the Chachamim were walking around the rubble of the Beis HaMikdash. Everybody else is crying, and Rabbi Akiva is laughing in joy. Why? Because the Chachamim looked to Rabbi Akiva and said, Akiva, how can you laugh at a moment like this? And he said, because of the fact that just as the nevuah of destruction came true, the nevuah of geula, the nevuah of redemption, will also come true. So even in this dark, dark time, Rabbi Akiva was able to see, if you can call it a silver lining, he could see the silver lining. He was the great optimist, right? And this Seder that we're talking about takes place in the aftermath of the Churban. And so the rabbis come to Rabbi Akiva and Bnei Brak to sit at his Seder in order to, strengthened and feel, and feel a little optimism, and to get some chizuk, as we would say, because they're living under Roman occupation, and and things don't look good, and so Rabbi Akiva is the place to go to when you need, when you need to be able to look forward and to look optimistically. The end of that Gemara, which people ordinarily quote around Tisha B'Av time, is Akiva Nichamtanu, that you have given us solace, consolation. Okay, so these are the two seders. One which was incorporated into the Haggadah, which is Rabbi Akiva optimism, which is Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, the big picture. Which is also the story of Kriya Shema, and that's the third, that's another one of the distinctions which we raised here. I think Jake, you made that point also. So this one talks about Shema. That one just talks about getting up in the morning to go to the Beis Medrash, ostensibly to daven, right? With the crow of the rooster in the morning. So again, not my own. This is a very interesting focus here. There are two times that we say Kriya Shema. What are we about to read? What's the next paragraph here? Am Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah teaches us. Hare ani kiven shivim shana v'lo zachisi sheteyamer yitzias Mitzrayim b'leilos. And my Haggadah here translates it, I did not understand why the story of the departure from Egypt should be told at night. Okay, anybody have a different English translation for that? Anybody have a different? I see a bunch of people have Art Scroll Haggadahs. How do they translate that? Rabbi Elazar said, what did he say? John, what do you have there?
I am like a 17-year-old man, but I do not succeed in having
Okay, so that's a slightly different translation. Who's your translator? That's an art scroll. Okay, so this is the Goldberg red and yellow one. This is the one that I grew up with. So which means it's Torah Misinai, right? Whatever Haggadah you grew up with, that's Torah Misinai. You have another translation? Okay, what does he say?
Here I am, a man of 70 years, yet I did not understand why the story of the departure from Egypt would be told at night until Ben Zoma explained.
Okay, so we have two different translations here. One is, I didn't understand, and the other was, I did not succeed in having it mentioned, right? That's what yours says. What do you have?
No, I'm sorry, I have the same translation, but what it actually says in Hebrew is what you just said.
Velo zachisi te'amer. I did not merit that it should be said. So You know, so does that mean I didn't understand it, or I didn't what? So, one way to translate this or to understand this is that I did not succeed, I did not merit in having it mentioned means that, you know, he was one of the rabbis. And, you know, there was the debate. When do you say Shema? So we all say Shema. If you look in the Siddur, the Shema is to be recited twice a day. By Yom Uvalayla. It's supposed to be done in the morning and the evening. Right? But there was a thought that maybe Kriya Shema should only be said once a day, during the daytime. And this is what Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is saying. That he didn't succeed in convincing the other rabbis of the efficacy or the halachic rectitude of a double recitation of Shema each day, one in the morning and one at the nighttime, until Ben Zoma came along. And Ben Zoma provided the halachic basis for saying Shema twice a day. Right, why is this significant? Let's just read it through. Until Ben Zoma came along, and he taught the following. The pasuk says, "Laman tizkor yom tzeischa me'aret Mitzrayim," that you shall remember the day you left Egypt. Kol yimei chayacha, all the days of your life. Yimei chayacha hayamim, the days of your life means the daytime. Kol yimei chayacha, all the days. The kol yimei chayacha, that means the day and the nighttime. That was his position. B'chachamim omrim. Chachamim say, Yimei Chayecha Olam Hazeh, Kol Yimei Chayecha Lahavi Limos HaMashiach. That Yimei Chayecha means the days of your life, meaning when you're alive, and Kol Yimei Chayecha, not when you're alive, the current status of life, and Kol Yimei Chayecha, all the days is Lahavi Limos HaMashiach, even after Mashiach comes, we will still mention Yitzias Mitzrayim. So, here, it's an interesting thing. Shema is one thing, Yitzias Mitzrayim is something else, but we sort of put them all together, you know, in our recitation. The fact of the matter is that Shema is recited during the day and at nighttime. That's how, you know, we recite Shema, and that based on, you know, simple read of the Psukim, we recite Shema. Yitzias Mitzrayim is sort of an added element here. So there are two times that we can say that we say Shema. We say Shema in the good times during the day. And we also say Shema. We know how many, you know, Jews over the course of the millennium have had to say Shema at nighttime. They've had to say Shema as they've been to their deaths. They've had to say Shema to Al Kiddush Hashem. And the same thing of what Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is saying here in the name of Ben Zoma is, what is Yitzias Mitzrayim, which we tack into Shema? Yitzias Mitzrayim is a statement of redemption. We make that statement of redemption not just good during the good times, not just when things are well, but we make that statement of redemption even during the bad times, and especially during the bad times, even at nighttime. We make a statement of redemption just like Hashem redeemed us from Egypt. He will redeem us from this galus during the daytime when things are all well and good. But especially Balayla, when things are terrible, then we also say Yitzias Mitzrayim, a statement of our faith and optimism. Just like Hashem saved us in days of old, He will again save us in the future. Who was Ben Zoma who taught us this? Ben Zoma was Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's junior. He was a young man. He's called Ben Zoma, right? He's a young man. And this is a fascinating thought to think about here. What does Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah say? He says, I was like 70 years old. Everybody knows the story. What does it mean, I was like 70 years old? Anybody remember the story? What does it mean, Harayani Kiven? Why doesn't it say, I was Shivim Shana? Right. Everybody remembers the story, maybe, you know, in school or another place you learned it, that when he was a young man, he was tapped to be the head of the Sanhedrin. In order to give him greater gravitas, you know, he woke up the next morning with a nice full white beard, so he should have the respect of his colleagues, even though he was just a young man. So Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says, "Hare ani kiven shivim shana." I'm like 70 years old, which means that he's saying he's a young man. He's a young man, but he has the gravitas of a 70-year-old man. V'lo zachisi shetayamer yetzias Mitzrayim, and despite that gravitas, I did not merit to convince my colleagues of the importance of yetzias Mitzrayim at nighttime, of recitation. So what was the whole point here of saying that, you know, that I was like a 70-year-old man? Here's really, it was irrelevant. It didn't work. It didn't help. I mean, it might have helped him get the job, you know, but it didn't help him, at least in this case. So why is he drawing our attention to that point? If he's drawing our attention to that point, you would think it's because of his gravitas, despite his youth, that he was successful. But he wasn't successful. He had to rely on Ben Zoma. So what does Ben Zoma come to teach us? Ben Zoma was even Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's junior. And from that junior colleague, that is where the teaching came from. In other words, there are two types at the Seder, if you will. There is the older generation, the wise and wizened generation, and then hopefully there is a younger generation. So who's doing the teaching? Right? We said Manishtana, everybody's a sofer. Who's doing the teaching? So you would think the older generation is teaching the younger generation. That's the handing over of the Masorah, the tradition. But the answer is that no, turns out Ben Zoma's the teacher. The youngest one is the teacher. What?
Because he's asking.
Well, no, not because he's asking the questions. He gave the answer. Ben Zoma is the one who provided the answer. Rabbi Eliezer ben Azariah's junior colleague is the one who provides the answer that sways the opinion of the rabbis, right? So the answer does not necessarily come from the oldest person at the Seder, from the smartest person at the Seder, from the wisest person at the Seder. Sometimes you need a pair of fresh eyes to take a look at it and to see that, you know, and to provide the answers. Again, I'm not attributing this appropriately, but this is not my own thought. But I would like to extend this even further. And that is, if you look at the next section, right after this, okay, we have the story of the four sons. And to me, it's interesting that if you look at the four sons, what is the question that the Chacham, the wise son, asks? What's the question? What is the question that the wise son asks? Right? My Eidos v'chokim v'mishpatim. What is the meaning of the rules and the laws of customs which Hashem commanded us? Okay, what does the Rasha say? Right, Mavod Azos Lachem. Okay, and keep reading a little further. Right. He took himself, you know, out of the whatchamacallit, right? And the Baal Haggadah has pretty tough words for how to treat somebody like that. Okay, but we'll leave that explanation for maybe another time. Next, Tam. What does the Tam ask?
What is this?
He just says, "What is this?" Mazos. We answer him whatever we answer him. Sheino yodea lishol. Right. So this section of the four sons, four different questions, four children, if you will, four different questions. So Sheino yodea lishol. I get it. We just give him the answer. He can ask. The Tam. I also get Mazos. He asks a question, and we give him an answer. And the Chacham, he also asks a question, and we give him the answer. The Rasha, we don't really answer him at all. And yet, I take that back. It's not that we don't answer him. We answer him, but we answer him a little harshly. It says, Hakeya Shinav, you know, knock him in the teeth. you know, which there are all types of apologetic explanations to soften that, you know, sharpen his teeth, make him smarter, all that. But leaving that aside, there is the second thing. It says, "Vemar lo," and say to him. So it's not just hakeyashina. There is something you respond to him, and that is Baburzas Hashemli, etc., etc. All this, all these four sons, all these four questions and answers, they are preceded by Baruch Hamakom Baruch Hu. What is the function of Baruch Hamakom Baruch Hu? Baruch Shenasan Torah La'amo Yisrael. It's basically a version of Birchas HaTorah. Right? Baruch HaTorah Hashem. Right? Nosein HaTorah. Right? Baruch HaMakom, Baruch Hu. Baruch Shenasan Torah Li'amo Yisrael Baruch Hu. It's a version of Birchas HaTorah. And it seems to me quite interesting, that we say Birchas HaTorah on the Chacham, on the Tam, and on the Eina Yodea Lishol. That's all well and good. But we also say Birchas HaTorah on the Rasha. Why do we say Birchas HaTorah on the Rasha? So I would suggest that the reason we say Birchas HaTorah on the Rasha is because we learn from everyone. There's Torah to be learned from everyone, even from the Rasha. The others, it's easier to learn because really they're asking us questions and we're giving them answers that we might already know. When the Rasha asks, that's a challenge question. That forces us to think about, you know, what we know and maybe what we don't know. There's what to learn from everyone at the Seder. And which goes back to the immediate previous point we said, was that who's the sofer? Who is the one who's inscribing and who is the receiver? And the answer is, we're all the soferim and we're all the receivers. We're all the sefer and we're all the sofer. It depends, you know, it depends who's talking. It could be Ben Zoma, the most junior person at the Seder. We have what to learn from that person. It could be, you know, Shivim Shana. It could be the most senior person. But when it comes to the Masorah, when it comes to passing on the tradition, passing on our identity, to bringing the notion of Yitzias Mitzrayim, which is to stand before Har Sinai and receive the Torah, and that is what we are passing on, there we are all Sfarim, we are all books waiting to be impressed upon, and we can all be Sofrim, we can all be the ones that impress upon impress upon the other. Okay, so there we have, Manishtana, Maisa Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, and the four sons. I want to go back now to Halach Ma'anya for a moment, and so I told you I'm skipping around a little bit, not exactly going in order. All right, so when it comes to Halach Ma'anya, that's really, we start the Seder with Kiddush, which is appropriate. Which is, you know, setting, as we said, setting the tone. And Manishtana certainly sets the tone. Halach Ma'anya also sets the tone, right before Manishtana. So why do we begin the Seder with Halach Ma'anya? So anybody have some classical answers of why we begin with Halach Ma'anya? This is the bread of affliction, the achalu avasana that our forefathers ate in Egypt. Whoever is hungry, come and eat. Whoever needs, let them come and eat the Karban Pesach with us. L'shana haba be'arad Yisrael. Hashta avdei l'shana haba b'necharim. This year we are slaves. We are here. We are in exile. Next year we will be free in Israel, in Yerushalayim. Right? L'shana haba b'necharim. So why do we begin the Seder with Halach Ma'anya? So in a certain sense, Halach Ma'anya is the cliff notes, or I don't know what they have these days, or the monarch notes, or whatever online version they have, which obviates the need for actual reading. I think they could just stick a chip in their brains and then they don't actually have to know anything. So Halach Ma'anya is actually good cliff notes for the Seder. It incorporates some of the basic themes. So the last theme is clear, Geula, right? L'shana haba b'nei chorin. Just before that, Hashata hacha. Right now we are in exile. That's also an important theme of the Seder. We have the exile and redemption of the Seder. We have maror and we have we have maror and karpas on the one hand, and we have matzah, which is the food of redemption, on the other hand. We have and leaning, on the other hand. So this is, this incorporates, the good theme of the Seder. You start off your Seder by sort of mentioning your themes of the night. Well, what about the halach ma'anya, mentioning matzah? So that's also an important theme of the night. That's the major mitzvah of the night, right? So that's all well and good, right? And then the middle part here, kol dichvin yeseh v'yechol, kol ditzer yeseh v'yifsach. Whoever wants to come and eat, come and eat. So that's all well and good. I mean, fine, but it's not really a theme of the night. I mean, you go through the Seder. The Seder talks about exile. The Seder talks about redemption. The Seder talks about the Seder talks about matzah. The Seder talks about those are the themes of the night. But what's called the Chvin Yeseh V'Yechol? Yeah.
You should only do that once you achieve the opposite of the halach ma'anya situation and status. Once you achieve the greatness, meaning the rule, or the richness, or the wealth of this world, however you want to say it, once you achieve that status, which is sort of a polar opposite to this one, you can be magnanimous and invite everyone.
Yeah, but we're not. We are saying hashta hacha. We are now in exile. So
we're also saying anyone who's hungry, come and eat. We say that.
Oh, in other words, we are saying that as a sort of, as an expression of our cheirus.
Correct.
As an expression of our cheirus. Okay? All right? Good? Yeah?
It always bothered me that the meaning, because to me it sounded hypocritical. Because we are telling to come in, whoever is hungry, we are not waiting at the door for people
passing
by. So, when you come here about Malachitim, then it put it together, the explanation, so it makes sense. So, my whole point about being so critical, that same thing, was
okay, so basically the point of your comment is to say what a great writer I am, and I just want to point out that I want to reinforce what John said, which is that it does seem a little bit hypocritical, and I did mention this in the bulletin message that we're sort of looking into our coat jackets and saying, whoever wants to come, come in, and nobody's coming. So what I wrote, and I want to certainly reinforce, is that if we want to not be hypocritical, then we should all make sure to give Maos Chitim before Pesach. And I will say that in Shul again, this Shabbos. So that way when we come to the Seder, we say, Kol Dichvin Yeseh V'Yechol, whoever wants to come and eat, we know that we have taken care of somebody. Okay, so yes, it's an expression of Cheirus, and if we give Maos Chitim beforehand, then maybe it removes some sense of hypocrisy. But even if we don't give Maos Chitim beforehand, and there's some level of hypocrisy there, there is value to this being at the beginning of the Seder. And I'm going to start this now, but we're going to maybe leave you a little bit of a... maybe continue it next time and finish out the thought and round it out. It's a longer thing than just what I'm going to say. But take a look at the Rambam on your page. The Rambam in Hilchas Yom Tov, Halacha 18. Okay? Right? So the Rambam in Hilchas Yom Tov, Halacha 18 says, he's talking about the nature of Simchas, of joy on Yantif. He says, what is implied? Children should be given roasted seeds, nuts, and sweets. For women, one should buy attractive clothing and jewelry according to one's financial capacity. You can figure out if that's relevant. Men should eat meat and drink wine. Right? These are certain paradigms that the Rambam had based on the Talmud. For there is no happiness without partaking of meat. right? Nor is there happiness without partaking of wine. Okay, so basically, leaving the particulars aside here for a second, what is clear is that on Yontif, simcha, joy, is defined in good old Jewish fashion, eating. Okay, eating and drinking, right? So that's how, you know, that's how Jews express their happiness, right? A good Jewish mother, before her child leaves to go down the block, says, "Let me pack you something to take," right? You know, food, right? We're very food oriented. So the Rambam continues, when a person eats and drinks in celebration of a holiday, he is obligated to feed the converts, the ger, the widow. In other words, people that are in a precarious, compromised situation, and others who are destitute and poor. In contrast, a person who locks the gates of his courtyard and eats and drinks with his children and his wife, without feeding the poor and the embittered, is not indulging in rejoicing associated with a mitzvah. That's not simchas mitzvah. I have a nice seder, I have my brisket or whatever, and I'm enjoying and sitting fat and happy. That is all well and good if it is paralleled with one other element, and that is helping somebody else out, helping the poor, the orphan, the widow, etc. These are all sort of paradigms for individuals who are in a compromised position. Doesn't necessarily mean that every ger, every convert, is in a compromised position, but these are paradigms of individuals who are in a compromised position. And therefore, if we don't feed the poor and embittered, so he says, this is not rejoicing associated with mitzvah, but rather this is a rejoicing of his gut. Right? The language of the Rambam is simchas kreso. It's a very crass, actually, very base description. It means, like he writes here, but it's even stronger. It means you're just having a good, a nice full belly. Has nothing to do with anything noble or spiritual or anything refined. It's just filling my gut with some dead meat. You know? So that's what he says. And the way to transform that from having, a simchas kreso, just having my belly full, into something really sublime, is by sharing with others and making sure that the poor amongst us has. And that's what he says. That is the definition of simcha on Yontif. So that's generally speaking. So it seems to me that when it comes to Pesach, the Baal Haggadah is saying, however important this is for all other holidays, it is super important for Pesach. Because we begin the Seder with, Kol dichvin yesev yechol, whoever is hungry, come and eat. So the question becomes, and this is where I'll leave you off for today, why is it so significant, more significant than any other holiday, than any other yontif? What is the significance of kol dichvin yesev yechol, of sharing with those who are hungry, more than Shavuos, more than Sukkos, specifically Pesach? So that is a more than a one-word answer, and it's one which I'm going to explore next week, how Kol Dichvin is a central theme of the Seder and a central theme, therefore, of Pesach. I want to just along those lines to point out how sharing with the poor and so on is so significant. Share with you something that that Rav Soloveitchik said. Rav Soloveitchik, again, I saw quoted, said that we're supposed to have halach ma'anya, lechem oni, right? Why? What is lechem oni? Lechem oni. Why? What is the poor man's bread? So that's that's the matzah that we take, and we take by yachatz, and we split that matzah up into two pieces. We keep one piece. We keep one piece for us. Anybody order a pizza? Okay. We keep one piece for us, and we put for now for the matzah, and we put one piece away for the afikoman. So Rav Soloveitchik says that yachatz, in a certain sense, is you know, a symbol of a broken matzah, right? We were broken in Egypt. We were broken. We were slaves. And we're, you know, we have half now, we have half later. But there's another way to look at yachatz. In Egypt, if I can borrow from American history, there were the plantation slaves and then there were the house slaves, right? The house slaves, you know, did pretty okay. And if, you know, in a slave situation, they did all right. They had plenty to eat. They were well dressed. They, you know, they did okay. Well, slavery in Egypt was not entirely dissimilar to that. As the rabbis point out, the Levium, for example, they were slaves in Egypt, but they were not the plantation slaves. They were not forced to go out and work. So there were different strata of avadim, of slaves in Egypt, and not everyone was, you know, on the lines building the pyramids, making sure that you know having somebody whipping them on the back. So some people had more, some people had less. So the people with more had to share with those who had less. Yachatz, says the Rav, we break the matzah. It's not breaking the matzah as a sign of brokenness or of lechem oni. It's breaking the matzah is a symbol of sharing with somebody else. Ha lachma anya chalu avasana de Mitzrayim. This is the bread of affliction that our forefathers ate in Egypt. Kol dich v'nyesei v'yechol. Whoever wants to come and eat, come and eat. Kol dich v'nyesei v'yechol is describing to us the lechem of our forefathers in Egypt, where they had to share. Those who had more had to share with those who had less. So we establish then that this notion of, you know, sharing with the poor, of giving to others, seems to be a very important theme in the Seder. It's so important, it makes it into the introductory cliff notes. And it's so important as well that it's actually a defining characteristic of the matzah according to this interpretation of Rav Soloveitchik. So the question then becomes, which leave you on the cliffhanger, which we'll address next time, why? What is so significant about about this? So maybe it's like Chaim said, it's just, you know, we're sort of declaring that we're going to, you know, one day be be free and we'll be able to be luxurious. But it doesn't explain it entirely, because the bread in Egypt, which was a bread of affliction, was also a bread of sharing. So the question that I leave you with is, what is so significant, even more so than other holidays, that this works it in to the defining characteristic of the Seder, the defining characteristic of matzah, which helps us understand, hopefully, maybe, how we will ultimately get to the third part of the Halach Ma'anya, which is Hashta Avde L'Shana Haba B'nei Chorin. So we'll try to, you know, put that all together next time. And we'll stop now. Okay. Thank you for coming.